It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's the Grand American Nut, the snubbed Grand American Nut. Well, we're talking the peanut, the blue collar in a nut world of white tie and tails. People don't take the peanut seriously. And I say, enough. Food writer Wendell Brock grew up on a Georgia peanut farm, and he's unearthed the caviar of goobers. For the Stearns, it's a drive-in with a California twist. Napa Valley's Taylor's refresher, as in Chardonnay with that. Beer Authority Stephen Beaumont has strong blondes, chocolate and spice, and a wine lover's beer, all from monks in Belgium. And then it's new music to party and clean up by from world music guy Bob Duskus. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today we've an overlooked gem, the American peanut. Food writer Wendell Brock takes us back to his roots, his family's peanut farm in Georgia. Now, he talks the one peanut he'd eat in heaven and the little-known, at least outside the South, boiled peanut. Like sweet peas, he says. Well, beer lover Stephen Beaumont is getting religion. He talks the highly individual monastery beers of Belgium. Then the music guy who cooks, Bob Duskus of Six Degrees Records, has new sets for grilling, partying, and cleaning up. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Michael, Jane, have you guys gotten out to California lately?
We've been everywhere. What's the song? I've been everywhere.
Oh, no, don't
man,
sing, please, Jane. No, no.
The USA, man.
No.
You don't like monotone singing. Yes, we have been to California.
And in fact, we've been to wine country. And when we go to wine country, what we do is eat. And the place we go to eat, one of the great places to eat in wine country, in St. Helena, in fact, is a restaurant called Taylor's Refresher. Now, if you look at Taylor's Refresher, it looks like a regular old-fashioned American drive-in. And in fact, that's how it began in 1949. But in fact, it is a drive-in with a California twist.
And what's the California twist?
Well, for example, you can have wine by the glass to accompany your 1/3-pound hamburger.
Would you care for a 79 Merlot?
Or, Lynn, let me say that if you don't want to order wine by the glass, you can bring your own bottle of wine, and they charge you a minimal corkage fee for that.
And what about the seared tuna burger with Asian coleslaw? I mean, this is kind of, you know, a very high-end road food experience. The funny thing is, when we were at this place, Michael and I were staying at a fancy in-spa hotel thing whose name escapes me. And to relax, I treated myself to a wine massage where they like mush wine grapes all over you, and it was really delightful and refreshing, except I stunk like a wino for like the entire day. So I don't really remember that much about the taste of food because I couldn't get past
the smell
my
of the
own aroma.
So now, when you say a drive-in, it is this a place where they bring the food to the car?
No. You order your food at a window, but they do have picnic tables for you to eat at. And let me just say that even though it does have some upscale and kind of California aspects to it,
right,
if I had to have one meal at Taylor's Refresher, it would be their 1/3-pound hamburger topped with bacon, cheddar cheese, barbecue sauce, mushrooms, and maybe a little mayonnaise. That, to me, is not exactly California cuisine, but it's really good.
You know what I would have is their garlic fries.
Yes.
Those are the best. They're French fries dipped in butter, garlic, and parsley sauce. You know, I mean, that part of California, it really is like shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, you cannot eat badly.
And if you don't want to have wine with the fries, you can have a really delicious milkshake.
Now, but the thing, too, that sounds, I mean, I'm gathering, this place is not as expensive as most of the places in the Napa Valley. I mean, that's pretty pricey eating territory.
No, it's really kind of a glorified luncheonette. You know, even though it does have things, it has like a winter salad that includes candied walnuts, sliced pears, and blue cheese. But, you know, for that part of the country, that is not very exotic.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of, you know,
down
that's
home.
What you eat down home. And
you can have a decent meal there in the high single-digit prices. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's not bad. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. Well, a lot of good cars.
Michael Stern have updated their classic guide, Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. We got an interesting, to say the least, email from a friend this week. It's an idea for a party. Okay, ready? Now, I'm quoting it. This is a recipe. Have guests write their name on a quart-sized Ziploc freezer bag with permanent marker. Crack two eggs into the bag. Shake to combine them. Put a variety of ingredients such as cheeses, ham, hash brown, salsa out. Each guest adds prepared ingredients of choice to their bag and shakes. Now, make sure to get all the air out of the bag and zip it up. Place the bags in rolling boiling water for exactly 13 minutes. Open the bags and the omelet will roll out easily. Be prepared for everyone to be amazed. And all I can say is, wow. Beer expert Stephen Beaumont constantly tracks down exceptional beers. He treks the globe, tastes, and reports on his website and in his books. Steve writes for national publications. His book, Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, is in its second edition. Hey, Steve, haven't seen you for ages. Welcome.
Oh, it's good to be back, Lynn.
You know, Stephen, I'd like to talk about Belgian beers. Now, I remember when I lived in Belgium, it seemed every monk made Trappist beer. You didn't go to the liquor store for your weekly six-pack. You know, you went to the monastery. But is this still alive and well? Are they still doing that?
Well, you know, isn't that a great concept, going to the monastery for
yeah,
your beer?
Yeah, I always thought
I just think that's
cool.
Wonderful. And yeah, they still do it. Although, of course, nowadays, they ship the beer out a little more. The monks are a little more commercially active. And as it happens, you can now buy beer from 5 of the 6 Trappist monastery breweries in the United States.
Oh, really? I didn't realize they were all available here. But can you explain, because they were known, I mean, the overall sort of generic term in Belgium was Trappist or Trappist beers. So is this a particular style of making a beer?
Well, this is where it gets confusing, Lynn, because a lot of people assume that all the Trappists are going to taste pretty much the same because they're all Trappist beers.
Right.
The truth of the matter is that they're very, very different. So you look at something like Orval, which is brewed, it's the only beer produced by the Abbey Notre-Dame d'Orval in the south of Belgium. And it is one of the world's most unusual beers in that it has component parts of it that are sweet, sour, and bitter. You don't often get those three flavors showing up in a single beer.
Huh.
And it couldn't be more different than something like the Rochefort 8, which actually has a chocolatey flavor to it and is one of the world's greatest beers for drinking with chocolate desserts.
Huh. What about the other four? You said they were 6.
Well, we've also got Chimay, the world's most famous Trappist brewery.
Right.
They
right.
produce the most beer and they're distributed around the globe. They have 3 beers, one of which, the middle one, which is known as Chimay White, has a good bitterness to it. And that's the one, that's the only Trappist beer in the U.S. that you're going to find on draft. So it's unique in that regard. And then up to the north, we've got Achel. It's a bit of a mouthful, that one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the newest Trappist Abbey, if you can believe that. And they've only been brewing for, I think, about 10 years now. They used to have a brewery. They had a brewery before World War II, but it kind of got dismantled during the war by the Nazis they dismantled a lot of breweries around Europe to use the metals in armaments.
I see. What does it taste like?
The Achel, they've just come out, you know, when they first started brewing, they were very conventional because they sit on the border between Belgium and Holland. And a lot of cyclists come by and they like to drink in the cafes. So the brewers at Achel didn't want to produce big, heavy alcoholic beers because that's not what you want to drink when you get back on your bike.
Mm-hmm.
So they went with lighter beers, but recently they've added some really intense and incredible beers, including one that's called Achel Extra. It's a 9.5% alcohol beer in a 750 ml bottle with just this big, rich, malty character, huge complexity. It's a delicious beer. It really impressed when it came out. And, of course, I can't miss Westmalle. Westmalle makes what may be the world's most famous strong blonde ale, Westmalle Triple. And that's also recently fallen under the auspices of an importer in the U.S. called Marchand de Vin, who have three of the six Trappist Abbeys represented by them. And Westmalle Triple is one of the world's most complicated beers. This is the one I serve to sommeliers because they love the complexities that they get out of it.
What would you eat with these beers?
Well, of course, every beer is a bit different. The first one I mentioned, Orval, is a wonderful beer for steaks. Westmalle Triple is famous for its affinity to asparagus, especially white asparagus.
Now that's interesting because it's very hard to figure out what to drink with asparagus.
Exactly. And of course, I mentioned Rochefort and chocolate.
Right.
Incredible.
And then the Chimay. What would you have with Chimay?
Chimay is, of course, they make the three different ones, so they all match a little differently. But if you look at the Chimay Premier, their most basic, is a 7% alcohol, very spicy ale. I enjoy it with cheeses, especially soft, pungent cheeses that are really the specialty of Belgium. In fact, most of these beers, that's the one common link, I guess you could say, that they have. They do go nicely with cheese.
Interesting. A beer and cheese tasting. Hey, Stephen, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Stephen Beaumont is author of Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. Now, you can find his Belgian Trappist picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Each week, we send you a quick worknight supper recipe, and we always have shopping and technique tips. But best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the caviar of peanuts and a world-beat Maven's music to grill by. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. It's confession time. If you check under my car seat, you will find a can of peanuts. There's another one at the back of my nightstand drawer, and a bag's in my office. It's behind the dictionary. The truth is, I love peanuts. I think peanut worship is sorely lacking on the American food scene. And to remedy that situation, we are meeting up with food writer Wendell Brock. Now, he grew up on a Georgia peanut farm, and he's done a sort of memoir treatise on peanuts for Savour magazine. Hey, Wendell, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, I understand that fall is harvest season for the peanut in Georgia. What is it like to be in that harvest?
It's really overwhelming and dusty and hot and kind of like having a hairdryer blowing hot dust in your face. The land is it's a beautiful landscape. Lots of Spanish moss and oak trees all around, everywhere except in the peanut fields, which are like completely flat, like a desert almost.
Are they harvested by machine or are they?
They are. They're harvested by these combine contraptions that look like they are survivors from Green Acres. they're the same now as I remember them 30 years ago.
Now, do the peanuts then actually go from there right there to roasting, or is there are there steps in between?
Well, before they're even picked off the vines, they're allowed to sit in the field for a while and dry out, but they still need a lot more drying to get rid of the moisture. So they're plugged into these, well, they're dumped into these sort of red wagons or trailers, and then these big, huge dryers are attached to the trailers, and they're dried for a while. And one summer I had a job working at a peanut mill, and my job was to test the moisture sample to make sure that the peanuts were ready, that they were dry enough.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to scoop down into the trailer and get the peanuts and then do a moisture test to make sure they were ready.
Oh, that sounds like it. I mean, I love peanuts, but I have a feeling that that might be just a little bit over the top.
Yeah, it really is. And once was enough.
So, Wendell, what is actually in that can?
Well, there's a lot in that can, Lynn. I mean, there's obviously peanuts and sometimes a little bit of salt. But if you dig a little bit beyond that, you could sort of trace the history of Europe and America. If you take the humble peanut, mm-hmm. which we know came from South America and was taken to Europe by the Spanish and the Portuguese and somehow got over to Africa with the slave trade and then came back to the States, kind of circuitous. And we're always, you know, kind of frowned upon. They were thought as a lowly food, not the elegant almond or hazelnut. But in 1904, I believe, at the St. Louis World Fair, mm-hmm. peanut butter made its debut. And shortly after that, there was World War II, and we couldn't get, home cooks couldn't get any kind of oil because all the oil we had was going for the war.
Right.
And so we realized how good peanut oil was. Then after that, peanut butter just took off, and during World War II, really hit its stride and started to be produced and eaten constantly.
It's probably an inexpensive source of a lot of nutrients. It makes sense that it would be great during the war because there were so many foods that people couldn't get their
exactly.
hands on.
Exactly, and I forgot to mention this during the Civil War, when soldiers were you know, stranded, trapped, mm-hmm. they couldn't mm-hmm. get out, they would just eat peanuts out of the field on both sides, and you know, sort of survived on that.
Yeah. There must be different kinds of peanuts. Are there distinctively different tasting peanuts?
I think there are. I think there's a big difference in the more common type, which is called runners, which are grown in all over Georgia, Alabama, uh-huh. Florida, Texas, the American South. That's the basic kind of peanut that's made into peanut butter that you'll find in a can of or a jar of Planters peanuts. But if you stray away a little bit from those, the Virginia peanuts, which are grown only in Virginia, are huge jumbo peanuts. They're excellent roasted. They're crunchy and a great, great cocktail snack, and you can do all kinds of things with those. And there are two other kinds which consumers probably know. The Spanish peanut, which is known for its kind of husky red skin.
Right.
They have a great flavor. I can't stop eating those. And then probably the most obscure is the Valencia peanut, which is grown out west in New Mexico. They're interesting. They have a sweeter kernel, and there are more of them to the pod, so they're the kinds you'd like to get because they're like four or five little kernels to the pod. So.
Mm. Tell me about the Southern boiled peanut, because I ran into this so many trips south. Nobody's heard of it up north.
They're interesting because peanuts, as you know, are a legume. They're not a true nut. They don't grow on trees.
Right.
They grow on vines under the ground. So when you boil a peanut, you're really getting it in its kind of its leguminous state. It's more like a pea or a bean. It's a, you know, it's wet.
Uh-huh.
We boil them in the shell, and all you need to add is a little bit of salt. And they're becoming more common now in farmers markets. You can find them green, and you could actually take those and use them just like a pea or a bean. You could make a ragu and add tomatoes and corn, okra. You can even think of the chickpea, which, you know, is mushed into hummus. You can do the same thing with peanuts.
So they're not crunchy when they're boiled then?
They're soft like a tender boiled pea.
Ooh.
And they're really good with beer. They make you thirsty and they make you drink more.
Say no more. I'm sold. Hey, Wendell, thank you.
Sure.
Food writer Wendell Brock's peanut article, Deep Roots, appeared in the August-September 2005 issue of Savour magazine. Now, Wendell left us with a recipe for chili peanuts. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, two brands of Virginia peanuts I remember being just swell are Hubs and the Virginia Peanut Company. Sing in the shower. Well, I let loose in the kitchen. I dance, I bang pots, salsa up to that stove, do a little pirouette to the sink, especially when I'm going to be entertaining. Now, all I need is just a little music, and this is where Bob Duskus comes in. He and his Six Degrees Records reign in world music, and Bob cooks big time. Hey, Bob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Lynn, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Bob. Now, this time of year, we've got, you know, kind of we're cooking outdoors, we're cooking indoors. I'm having some people over. Orchestrate for me.
Well, today we're actually going to talk about cooking outdoors and music for grilling. And we're going to break it up into three segments. We're going to talk about music to cook by, music to entertain your guests by, and music to clean up by. Because we like to orchestrate our cooking and our entertaining. And, you know, grilling is kind of a specific thing because it's, for a great number of men, the only cooking they actually do. So with apologies to, you know, the women out there who do actually light up the barbecue grill, our first selection is something that is a little bit testosterone fueled. And that's the new one from Robert Plant, who was the singer with the, of course, world famous rock band Led Zeppelin, and has been on a solo career many years. And unlike many of his contemporaries, Lynn, who sort of are thought of as dinosaur rockers from the old days, this guy has kept really contemporary and really fresh. And his new solo record, which is called The Mighty Rearranger, is the best thing he's done in a lot of years. And it sort of takes his old rock and roll roots, but combines them with electronics and soul music. There's even a little bit of doo-wop on this album. And it's just nice to see one of the old guys keeping current. He's got a really great young band with players who played in sort of contemporary bands like Portishead and Massive Attack. And this is just a great rockin' record that also has some brains to it.
This is the land where I live, painted all over golden. Take a little sunshine, spread it all around. This is the love that I give. These are the arms for the hold. Turn on your love light, shine it all around.
Bob, I know this is for the guys, but that is great. I can see myself at the grill.
Well, I think it's for everybody. You know, as we know, thousands upon thousands of young women also had Robert Plant posters on their walls in their rooms. So, you know, it's not just for the guys.
Yeah, but including our technical director, right on the ceiling of her dorm room, no less.
Ooh, on the ceiling.
Ceiling.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that'll definitely give you something rocking to grill by. And then when it comes to entertaining, Lynn, you want to cool things out a little bit. You don't want thundering drums and screaming guitars while your guests are sitting down to the meal. You want something that's conducive to conversation. And bossa nova music from Brazil is always perfect. And this is something from my label, Six Degrees Records, from a contemporary up-and-comer on the Brazilian scene named Celso Fonseca. And Celso is a protege of Caetano Veloso, which is sort of like saying, in American terms, a protege of Bob Dylan. Caetano is really of that stature in Brazil, one of their great statesmen and songwriters. And Celso has been continuing this tradition of beautiful bossa nova with smart lyrics, a little bit of samba in there. And his new record is called Rive Gauche Rio. And this should definitely inspire, you know, a nice ambiance while you're eating. It's not so ambient that it blends into the background, but it's pleasant enough where it can accompany the meal nicely.
Pra onde vou? Vou sem você. E isso deixa a frágil sensação de flutuar no espaço sideral e me perder no azul sem direção.
I, you know, the rhythm alone, it just feels like you want to eat, you want to talk, you want to listen. I love this, Bob.
Yeah, there's something about bossa nova that's perfect for dinner. You can go back to the classic old stuff. You know, there's always Stan Getz and Jorge Ben and João Gilberto, but it's nice also to get some of the up-and-comers, and Celso is definitely on that vanguard.
Does he have the political streak that Dylan has?
You know, Celso himself doesn't, actually. It's a little bit more about love, 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 and starry nights, and so lyrically it's a little more on the sort of smooth romantic side. But that's okay for dinner too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, then we have the dreaded cleanup. And as we know, that can always be something you're not looking forward to. So I always recommend for cleaning up, either get a favorite CD that you can sing along to and really get into, or soulful dance music is always perfect. And this new one is sort of a left field entry from a British guy named Jamie Liddell. Now, Jamie's very interesting, Lynn. He comes from a very experimental electronic background. He used to be in a band called Super Collider that was pretty noisy and pretty tweaky.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, he shocked everybody by coming out with this record called Multiply on the Warp label out of UK. And it's like a soul record.
It sounds like rhythm and blues to me. I mean,
it's a modern take on the Otis Redding, Sam Cooke sound. It's a little bit electronic, very subtle use of modern instrumentation, but Jamie's got one of those great soulful voices, and it sounds like a classic, but it also sounds new, and it's definitely guaranteed to put a little spring into your cleaning.
Oh boy, I could wash dishes to this. This is great.
Well, that's the idea.
You know, I think this has actually, for me, become your trademark. You always have people who tell you that this is, you know, music to cook by, this is music to dine by, and you do a brilliant job of it, but nobody ever gives you music to clean up by.
But think about it, it's sort of the most important part of the meal to orchestrate because it's the thing people look forward to the least, so you need something to make it a little more fun. And music's perfect.
Yeah, I can't believe it. You're actually making me look forward to washing dishes. Hey, Bob, thank you.
My pleasure.
Bob Duskus is co-creator of 6 Degrees Records. You can find Bob's music picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Well, let's get right to the phones. Let's see. We have got Graham on the line from Traverse City, Michigan. Hey, Graham, what do you want to talk about?
Spain. in
Spain.
In October, my mother and I are going to Spain, and we're walking from Pamplona to Santiago Compostela on pilgrimage.
Oh, Lord, what an experience.
I'm so excited.
Oh.
We're going to be eating out the whole way, no cooking. So.
Uh-huh.
And my Spanish is fairly adequate, except not for restaurants.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if you could recommend a book that has good phrases for how to recognize trout and things that we'll see on the menu.
Right. Well, already, speaking Spanish, you're going to get a lot of help. I mean, you can just ask for help.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing that comes to mind, whenever anybody says, you know, a guide like this, something to food names and how to manage, Lonely Planet. Lonely Planet does guides that are not only just the restaurants, but they're guides of exactly what you're talking about. And I think they do an awfully good job of it. There's, a capturing of the culture. So I'd take a look at Lonely Planet. World Food Guides are what they're called. And and it's by Lonely Planet. And I like it because there's a strong cultural element to it. So you have a sense of the culture around you and how that ties into the food. So that's what you should look for.
Great. Thank you.
You are welcome and have a wonderful trip.
Thank you.
It sounds like a great adventure.
It will be.
You take care.
Thanks.
Bye. 800-537-5252. That pilgrimage that she is talking about, that pilgrimage, you know, Coquille Saint-Jacques, the name for scallops in French? Well, it's the shell of St. James. And she is going to essentially where St. James supposedly was from. And it's a town in Spain. And that pilgrimage has been going on for 1,000 years. It starts in Paris and you go by foot. What an experience. Anyway, well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what's the Italian connection to America's favorite peanut treat? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the Italian connection to America's favorite peanut treat? I'm always managing to work in this Italian stuff. Anyway, the treat is peanut butter, and the Italian is Amadeo Obici. Now, Wendell Brock, in that Savour peanut article that he did, says that the nut didn't hit the big time until Obici introduced peanut butter at the 1904 World's Fair. Everybody wanted it. Now, the story gets better. In 1906, Obici was the first person to successfully market shelled and roasted peanuts in a can. And he called his new company Planters. I knew there was a genetic link to my love of peanuts. Well, okay, back to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We have got Paige from Minneapolis. Hey, Paige, what do you want to talk about?
Black beans.
Black beans?
Yeah. I lived in South America for a while, and when I was in Venezuela, I would make black beans and rice using a seasoning packet that didn't have MSG or beef because we're vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have any idea how to recreate that spice. I'm wondering if you could help me.
Were there any ingredients on it at all?
Well, there's celery and onion and stuff, but I've tried to recreate it, and it just, it's bland.
It's hard. It's hard to call that because as far as, you know, something that would be specific to Venezuela. All right. First of all, I think it would have dried cumin and coriander in it.
Okay.
And probably, as you mentioned, celery, carrot, and onion. Because I'm just thinking about so much of Latin America cooks black beans in very similar ways.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a bay leaf.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't doubt that there were some clove in it.
Oh, okay.
There may actually be a little bit of hot chili of some kind, like a little bit of cayenne. Not a lot. Okay. Just enough to give it sparkle. Pepper. Okay. Black pepper. And very possibly the other thing might be, and this will depend on where you are again, is thyme.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, every area is going to have its variations, and that manufacturer might be, you know, a little devil that has its own secret ingredient. But I think if you use celery, carrot, onion, mm-hmm. And you use, garlic. Oh, for goodness sakes, how could I forget? Some garlic.
I was just gonna ask about garlic.
Yeah. And then some ground cumin and coriander. And with ground cumin and coriander, for argument's sake, let's say if you've got a pound of black beans that you're cooking, I would say you probably want 2 teaspoons each of cumin and coriander because, you know, the beans absorb flavor. All beans do this. They suck up flavor and they mute flavors. And I always tend to over-season beans when I'm cooking them because by the time I get done cooking them, they're going to have a subtle taste.
Okay.
And the other thing that might be in there is some citric acid, a little bit of vinegar, but never add vinegar or anything acidic like tomatoes to cooking legumes of any kind until they're just about done because that hardens the beans.
Oh.
But sometimes there's a little acid, citric acid that's thrown in those seasoning packets because you want that just that little nice zing of something tart.
Well, this helps.
I mean, you know what? If it may not taste exactly the same, but it's going to get you close. And the other thing is it's certainly going to taste very good.
Oh, good.
All right. So try that.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You can call us, guys, 800-537-5252. That's kind of a set formula for making really flavorful beans. You know, the triumvirate celery, carrot, onions, and then the garlic, and then the bay leaf and the clove, and then throw in other spices as you love them. Okay, who's up next? We have got Michael calling from Bakersfield, California. Hey, Michael, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to find a good recipe for gumbo.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Do you love gumbo? Because gumbo is one of those things that has, you know, people either seem to love it or they could do without it.
Well, I was born and raised in Louisiana.
Oh, you know gumbo. You're asking me for a recipe? You should be calling your mom or your aunt.
Well,
hey, I'm a northerner. You know. Okay.
I'm sort of transplanted to El Paso, Texas.
Oh boy. Well, there's. I think you know this. There are two elements that are really traditional to gumbo, and one is a really slow cooked roux, the thickening agent, which is usually butter and flour or some kind of fat and flour that is cooked really slowly over a very low flame until actually the flour starts to turn kind of blonde. And then it gets really dark. You don't want to burn it, but that deep, rich, rich flavor that you get from a gumbo, one of the real secrets is a great roux. And I don't know if you grew up with this, but I know friends of mine in New Orleans talk about how their moms used to make pans of it. They would mix the flour with sometimes lard and butter, and they'd put it in the oven and bake it really slowly as the flour slowly browned in the fat, and they'd stir it periodically. And then they would store it in the fridge and just take a scoop of it when they wanted it for a dish. But you need that slow-cooked roux. So I would say equal parts of a really flavorful fat and flour. Okay. And I'd say if you've got the roux, you maybe want 2 or 3 tablespoons of it for, or 4 tablespoons of it for, a gumbo that's going to feed maybe 4 or 5 people. The other thing is that, you know, a gumbo is a stew. And some of the traditional ingredients to a gumbo would be, things, as you know, shrimp, crab, almost any kind of shellfish, a little bit of sausage. I mean, one of the great gumbos that I've had was done with just greens and ham hocks. And they were cooked with that roux in, you know, just water. And then there was a spice mix in there of bay leaves and cloves and a little bit of hot chili. And there was oregano and thyme, as I remember. And I think there was some majoram and tomatoes. And you cooked that ham hock until that ham hock was tender as could be. And then you threw in the greens. Now you can cook that ham hock and you can throw in the, you know, something like the shrimp, or you can throw in sausage. And what I don't remember is, what are the rules about what you don't mix in a gumbo and what you do mix in a gumbo?
Well, no, I was thinking of adding some chicken, possibly.
Oh, that would be great. You know, chicken and sausage in a gumbo is fabulous, too. That's the other thing. Now, the finish is the other great thing, which you're probably familiar with, which is you have to have filet powder. And filet powder is ground sassafras leaf.
That was my missing ingredient.
Is that it? Oh, so you've got it all except that. Okay, you can mail order that online.
I can?
Yeah. I can't tell you exactly where, but I'll bet you one place to start would be ethnicgrocer.com. And you know the trick to that is you take the stew off the heat and you stir it in. You never want to boil it, because if you boil filet powder, it gets stringy and tough. But that's the last, and it has that incredible smoky, woodsy, herby flavor.
Uh-huh.
And that's what makes a gumbo to me.
Excellent.
And then you have to serve it over rice. That's the other thing. You put it in a bowl. There's got to be rice in the bowl first. I was lectured in New Orleans when I said, I'll add my rice later after I taste it. And they said, no, get out of here. So I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Guys, I talked a while ago about the idea of caramelizing a ton of onions, and you could throw some vinegar in or whatever, and just keeping it in the fridge and using it like you would use jam, or you would use a salsa, or you would use mustard. And that's great. But I've got another one for you. Do raw onion, you know, just put it in the food processor, slice it super thin, and then toss it with shredded lime zest, lots of lime juice, and lots of minced chili, and some salt and pepper. And it's as hot as the devil, but it's tart at the same time. And if you want to, you can throw in a little bit of sugar. The onions are going to wilt, but they're still going to be raw. They're going to turn very mild, and then they'll have that punch in that heat. And you put this over cold rice. You put this on top of tomatoes. You put it on any sandwich you can think of. And if you've got, you know, something like a grilled piece of steak or even a piece of fish, pile a few of these on top of it. It is killer. It'll keep in the fridge for 2 weeks more. So that's it. Call us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have Julia calling from Bend, Oregon. Hey, Julia, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I have some questions about baking. I do a lot of baking, and I'm confused about what are the differences between cake flour, bread flour, all-purpose flour, stone ground flour, and why do I really need to use any of these specialty flours instead of just all-purpose?
It's a great question, and the difference basically is one word, protein. The more protein that there is in a flour, the harder, for lack of a better word, the flour becomes, meaning that it will be a stronger flour. So, for instance, when you're making bread, where you take a dough that's essentially if you think about it, it's water and it's salt and it's yeast and flour, right? And you knead it and you want it to get very stretchy and very elastic, because what's going to happen when you bake that is that all that stretch and elasticity that you've developed from the kneading is going to expand and give the bread structure. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, the more protein that you have in the bread, the more elasticity you're going to get from the dough. So that's why you hear something called bread flour. It has a lot more protein in it.
Mm-hmm.
Cake flour has the least amount of protein in it. And cake flour is used where, well, you need structure, but you don't need chewiness. You want lightness and you want delicacy.
Right.
All-purpose flour is the blend of the two. And believe it or not, all-purpose flour changes around the country. Now, the national brands like Gold Medal and Pillsbury, those stay the same. they're consistent. But if you go to, if you buy white lily in the South, white lily is, even if it, I don't even know if they make an all purpose, but white lily is a very soft flour, meaning it's like a cake flour. It's very low in protein. And it's wonderful for the South because that's where they make quick breads and biscuits. They don't do a lot of bread kneading. If you buy an all-purpose flour up where I live in Minnesota, it tends to be a much stronger flour, more protein. So those are the differences. And then stone ground, commercial flour is generally ground with metal rollers that shave off the layers on the wheat kernel until it gets down to the center where all the starches and all the flour comes from. Stone grinding grinds the entire thing in one fell swoop, and it grinds it quite fine. And then the whole wheat, you would get whole wheat flour when you first grind of stone ground flour, and then it's sifted to sift out the chaff, perhaps also the other solid particles.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So stone grinding, it's all ground at once, and then it's sifted to make white flour, or it's not sifted and you have whole wheat flour.
Okay, great.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have got Jill calling from Indianapolis. Hey, Jill, what do you want to talk about?
Well, a very interesting ingredient here that I had not seen. I mean, I'm not a baker, and I'm not a I like to dabble, let's just say that.
Okay.
And I found this in a recipe book that's called Sea Island Seasons, a collection of favorite recipes from apparently the Beaufort County Open Trust in South Carolina.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I bought that book actually when I was in St. Simon Island, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
Some while ago. But I was looking for banana bread, and I had came across mace to put into banana bread. And I was thinking, wow, well, I've never seen this. So what is mace? Of course, my husband says, what, the pepper spray?
You know, it's an old recipe you're probably talking about.
Yeah.
Mace is a net-like coating on the nutmeg. And it tastes very similar to nutmeg, but it's very gentle. And you don't see it around much now. But even 20 years ago, it was still hanging out there. I think if you check, I'm just thinking a couple of websites that might carry it would be Vans and Penzies. There's a place also called Spice World that may carry it. But it's this sort of net-like covering to the nutmeg. And it's like a more delicate flavor of nutmeg, and you probably could use nutmeg instead and be fine.
Okay.
And it's a lovely thing to sniff, by the way.
Yeah, but it has that nutmeg flavor.
Well, yeah, it's like nutmeg. You know, I'm one of those people, I never, ever did drugs, but I did a lot of sniffing of cinnamon and nutmeg. It's just great stuff. But anyway, that's what it is. And a lot of people know nothing about it these days. And it's an old spice, and it sounds like it's a great recipe.
Well, thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Okay.
Bye. 800-537-5252. The New York City Health Department is setting what I think is a precedent. They're asking all city restaurants to stop using trans fats in their food. Well, to see how the request has been heeded, we have on the phone Dr. Sonia Angel. She is Director of Cardiovascular Disease Prevention and Control at the New York City Health Department. Dr. Angel, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Has any other city's health department done anything like this?
This is the first large municipal request to restaurants that we know of, asking restaurants to voluntarily remove artificially produced trans fats from the products that they use to produce their foods.
And these are the fats that are very harmful, right?
These are the bad ones.
Yeah. What has the reaction been?
The reaction has been good. People have been very interested. And as you know, heart disease is the number one cause of death in the United States and in New York City also. Trans fats are bad for your heart. So for us to take this step and to educate both restaurant owners as well as consumers about the dangers of trans fats was a very important thing to do.
Is there any kind of regulation or enforcement to see how people are actually dealing with this?
This is an educational campaign, and it's a request that restaurant owners take trans fats out of the foods that they're serving. And we have done a survey of restaurants throughout the city to look at the level of trans fat use in foods that are being fried, in oils that are being used to bake, and also in the spreads that they're using, such as margarines. And we found that 30% of restaurants do have partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. Those are, mm-hmm. are oils that contain trans fats in the products. This was done strictly to have to give us information on a baseline of what the level of trans fat use is.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me is that trans fats are, those oils and fats are one of the things that save especially small operations, ones with very inexpensive food, a lot of money. And if you ask these people to switch to fats that are not trans fats, they get more expensive. And if I remember correctly, some of them break down more quickly. So, for instance, you have to change the frying oil more often. Is there any chance that the city might offer assistance to these small businesses?
Well, this is a request that businesses voluntarily switch over. But what I can say is, based upon our survey, we found that there was no specific type of restaurant that was not using trans fats, meaning that the types of restaurants that you're describing, some of those smaller ones,
yeah.
many of them also are not using partially hydrogenated vegetable oils and are in business and doing well. So, you know, the best thing to do would be to talk to the restaurants themselves about how they're
yeah.
doing without using partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. But we do know that there are a lot of restaurants out there that are getting by just fine without putting these artificial and dangerous products in their foods.
So how are you going to measure success of this project?
Well, we'll repeat this baseline survey in about a year to see what the response has been.
Great idea. Well,
yeah.
Doctor, thanks for talking with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Dr. Sonia Angel is Director of Cardiovascular Disease Prevention and Control at the New York City Health Department. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from actor Orson Welles. He said, "My doctor told me to stop having intimate dinners for four unless there were three other people present." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. You register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.